Okay. Yeah. Thank you for having me here. Yeah, I want to. Can you read the green one? I think it wasn't a very good color. Okay. Well, I want to talk about a paper that I published some couple of months ago, and there are some similar papers with some related content. One is by Lynn Maldacena and one by Kini Maldacena, Nirmala, and Raju. And well, I basically want to talk about how to count BPS states in n equals 1 superconformal field theories. And well, first I'm going to start by telling a little bit about group theory. What BPS multiplets there are, and I'll define an index. And then to calculate those things, I need to actually derive field theories, n equals 1 supersymmetric field theories on S3 cross R. I think for n equals 2 and n equals 4 superconformal field theories, that's not very important because basically the theories are classically already superconformal, and you can just map them on the S3 cross R. But for those n equals 1 theories, it's not necessarily possible. And well, then I'll talk about how to count those states. And first, I'll talk about ungauged theories. That's more as an example, because most ungauged theories are not believed to flow to some conformal fixed point in the infrared. But it's still a nice example, and then I'll talk about gauge theories in the chiral ring. So let me start with the group theory. So the four-dimensional superconformal group is SU2,2/1, and I'm just going to write down the generators. I don't write down very many commutation relations. But I'm using a notation which is kind of useful for S3 cross R instead of flat space or Minkowski space. So there I have a Hamiltonian, and then I have a SO4 symmetry of the S3, which is generated by some SU2 left and SU2 right generators, a U1R symmetry, and then I have something which I call conformal generators. And those basically, the transformation properties of those conformal generators are basically given here. So they have a charge -1 under the Hamiltonian, and the R charge 0, and they are doublets under SU2 left and SU2 right. So they are transforming like a vector under the SO4. And those are not, the K alpha beta dot are not Hermitian. So there's a complex conjugate to them, and you just have to take the real part or the imaginary part of that. And then there are the supersymmetry generators, which are Q alpha and S alpha dot. And the dotted index is always the index for the SU2 right and the undotted one for the SU2 left. And the only commutation relation that I write down is actually an anti-commutation relation between Q alpha and Q beta dagger. And there's some combination of the Hamiltonian in there and then the SU2 left. So it's actually fairly similar to the flat space supersymmetry algebra when you look at, when you view those as translation operators, the Ji, and that is a time translation. The only difference is that the Qs actually don't commute with all of those generators on the right-hand side. And from that anti-commutation relation, one can derive some BPS bounds. So there are two important ones. One you get by summing over alpha and beta and setting them equal. And then the last term on the right-hand side drops, and you basically get from unitarity that E, the eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian, minus 3/2, the R charge is bigger or equal than 0. And when you saturate that bound, you can easily prove that basically Q alpha and Q alpha dagger acting on that state annihilate the state, and also, and then from the anti-commutation relation it follows that that state is also a singlet under the SC2 left. And also one can see that H minus 3/2 R on that state, so where that is basically a lowering, it's a lowering operator with respect to the Hamiltonian, gives minus 2 S alpha dot on phi. So that's also forbidden by the BPS bound, so that state is vanishing. So from that follows that S alpha dot annihilates that state. And then from some other anti-commutation relation, it follows that K also annihilates its state. So it's a primary state. And because Q alpha dagger also annihilates the state, it's chiral. So it's a chiral primary. And typically, that state preserves, all primaries preserve 4 supersymmetries. But this preserves 2 more out of 4 plus 4, and that's called a half BPS state, because we kind of don't care about those 4. And there's a second BPS bound which you can get from for the right-hand side, and depending on whether that's saturated, it can actually be also 3/4 or BPS, or doesn't break the supersymmetry at all. If it doesn't break the supersymmetry, it's a vacuum. But then there's a second BPS bound, which leads to, I think Ferrara called it semi-long multiplets. I don't know whether that's a general accepted name. Basically, by setting alpha and beta in that anti-commutation relation that I had before, maybe I can flash that once again. That's that anti-commutation relation here. If I set alpha and beta to 1, then I get that BPS bound, that E minus 3/2 R minus 2J3 is bigger or equal than 0. And if one saturates that, one can easily prove that Q1 and Q1 dagger annihilate the state. And also one can make a unitarity argument that Q2 dagger annihilates the state and S alpha dot annihilate the state. This state is not a primary because it's not necessarily annihilated by Q2. If it was annihilated by Q2, it would be a chiral primary again. But it's a descendant, but actually this descendant is a BPS state in this semi-long multiplet. And this in n equals 1 language is 1/4 BPS. In n equals 4 language is known as 1/16 BPS. And depending on what's happening on the right hand, for the SC2 right, it can also be 1/2 or 3/4 BPS. And of course one can repeat the whole exercise for the other set of superchargers, the S alpha dots. So those are all the multiplets that I really care about. And basically, since I only care about the SU2 left and the Q alphas, the whole thing involves only a SU2/1. That's everything that I need in terms of group theory. And this SU2/1 is generated by H minus 3/2 R charge and JI left SU2 generators and the Q alphas and the daggers. And this subalgebra commutes with the SU2 right and this combination of the Hamiltonian and the R charge. And I can actually use that to define an index. And yeah. Yeah. And basically the index is supposed to be a trace minus 1 to the f, and one can look in the representations of SU2 slash 1. I mean, one can split all the representations of SU2 comma 2 slash 1 into representations of SU2 slash 1. And there are, again, three different types of representations, which are interesting, which are the long representations. And there one can see that in a long representation there is many fermionic states as bosonic states, and the trace minus 1 to the f would be 0 over such a representation. But the short representations, they said...
So the first
entry the delta that I wrote down is e minus 3 half r. Sorry, I flashed it up too fast. And yeah, again, basically the same classification holds that I had before, but here one can see better how what the trace minus 1 to the f would be. So in the short representations, which correspond to the semi-long multiplets that I was talking before, delta is 2j. And one can see that such a short representation is made out of two representations of the SU2 left. And there's a difference of one state. There's one more boson than fermions, or vice versa. And the trace minus 1 to the f over such a representation would be plus or minus 1. And of course, there's also the trivial representation, which corresponds to chiral primaries, and that contains one state, and the trace minus 1 to the f is plus or minus 1 again. And so now one can actually define the index, which is now the trace minus 1 to the f, and I can put generators of the commuting algebra in there. And actually, the e to the minus beta times h minus 1 half r is needed as a regulator, because the representations of the superconformal algebra are infinite dimensional. And to check that this is a good regulator, one can look at this inequality, which follows from the BPS bound. So that regulator is basically the Hamiltonian. It's bounded from below by the Hamiltonian. So it damps enough. And yeah, that's why it's kind of it's not really an index, it's a generating function for lots of indices in a sense. And yeah, of course one can also define another index if one is interested in the SU2 right. And it's basically analogous and not terribly much more interesting. And one other good point about this SU2 slash 1 instead of the full superconformal group is that basically this index is a topological quantity, and they can calculate it in the UV. And there, typically not the full superconformal group is preserved, but this is basically the maximal group, which includes only isometries, and then putting as many superchargers in there as possible. Yeah. Well, basically, in order to form a long multiplet, you always need to join short multiplets, and basically like the Witten index. It's the same mechanism. And actually, one can reduce it to the Witten index. And that's what Maldacena and friends did. They actually to define the index, you only need a SU1/1 subalgebra. And that commutes now with a SU2,1 in the superconformal algebra, but the result is the same. The Cartan generators of that guy basically can be viewed as, well, you basically have an SU2 right in there, and then there's an extra U1, and that U1 is generated by H minus 1/2 R. So the information is the same, but in that case, that is basically just that you have a Q and a Q dagger, and they anti-commute into something which you could call Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian commutes with all of those. So that's just the usual Witten index then. Okay. In any case, I only need that algebra to define my index, and for this reason I can define it in the UV when the theory is not conformal. And yeah, the index counts PPS states with a sign. Then I also need to mention that Maldacena and friends define some more general index for cases when there's more supersymmetry. But it's basically a direct generalization of that index. And they actually prove that what they have is the most general index. So if you just look what group theory tells you that you can count, and it's invariant under changing couplings and so on, they prove that this is the most general thing that they can write down. So they look at how long representations, when they hit the BPS bound, how they split up into short representations, and then they check, you know, what combinations they can take, which would be quantities which do not care whether something comes down or stays up or something like that. So now this is kind of the technical part of the talk. I need to construct now N equals 1 theories on S3 cross R, and you cannot get them typically by just conformally mapping theory in flat space to S3 cross R. And I want to preserve that symmetry that I was talking about. And, well, the space-time symmetries are generated in that field theory by some killing vector fields, the Hamiltonian time translation, and then you have some left and right lead derivative killing vector field. And then the R symmetry is generated by some scalar which is constant. And then the interesting thing is the killing spinors, which generate the supersymmetries. And to talk about spinors, I need to introduce a field bind. So I introduce, well, that's obvious, and that's the right invariant one forms. That's a little bit confusing. I'm interested in mainly in left action of the SU2, but I need to introduce the right invariant one forms, which are dual to the left derivative. And on top of that, the killing spinor is supposed to be chiral, so gamma 5 on theta is theta. And then I basically need to realize the commutation relations that I know from the group theory. And one of them is that the supersymmetry generators are singlets under SU2 right. So the right derivative. And actually that's just the usual derivative, but in that frame that I chose, it's actually also the knee derivative of the killing spinor. And that has to be zero That implies that the supersymmetries are not charged, don't transform under the SE2 right. But they need to be a doublet under the SE2 left, and the lead derivative for SE2 left is that thing. And since sigma I right on xi is zero, the sigma I left is also zero, because I have it for all sigma i's. Just all three derivatives in all three space directions are zero. So I get that, and from that one, those are basically Pauli matrices, so one can see that the killing spinor actually transforms as a 2 on the SE2 left. And on top of that, the commutation relations with the Hamiltonian tell me that the time derivative of the killing spinor is minus I over 2 times the killing spinor. And one can construct such a spinor very easily, which is just that thing. It's chiral, and that's just a constant spinor. And so that thing is a 2 vector, actually. So the whole thing is a 4 vector. And yeah, it has a time dependence. And then one can construct chiral multiplets and some Wessomino model. So a chiral multiplet, I basically now repeat more or less what's written in Wess and Bagger, but for S3 cross R instead of flat space. So I won't be very, I won't take very long. But a chiral multiplet again contains a scalar, a complex scalar, phi, a super partner, which is psi, and an auxiliary field F. And the transformation laws I wrote down there, they're basically like in Wess and Bagger, like in flat space, except for that term and that term here. But otherwise, it's pretty much covariantized whatever is happening in flat space. And it's made in such a way that the supersymmetry algebra closes in the way which I want from the group theory point of view. It's basically wherever I have a time derivative, I can put another constant there as well. So I have here dt plus a constant, and here I have dt plus a constant, and that constant is R charge dependent, but it's not necessarily proportional to the R charge. It's some more general function. Yeah, you can. You basically take the limit where you make the S3 very big, and you zoom in on a little patch, and you can see that you get the result from Wess and Bagger. Yeah, I fixed it to 1. So I would, if I put the radius in explicitly. Yeah. And the Lagrangian looks like that. So there's basically the kinetic term, Lagrangian, which now has those funny connection terms here. And the interesting thing is for a scalar with the usual R charge, which is 2/3, those terms drop out. And also that funny term for the fermion drops out, and then it's just the covariantized free scalar and free fermion. But if you have another R charge, those terms are actually important. And the only extra thing that you get, which Wess and Bagger didn't get, is that actually the superpotential needs to be a homogeneous function. It needs to have R charge too. That's because the R's the U1R symmetry generator is in the anti-commutation relations of the queues, which doesn't happen in Wes and Bagger, and that forces that. Pi is 2 over q, so I can choose integer powers there. I just have to adjust my R charge such. Yeah, that would be singular then, I guess. But presumably the procedure would be that you actually pick your superpotential first. It needs to be homogeneous, and you just put some integer power there, and then you adjust your R charge to that. Yeah. I think so, yeah. Of course, if you have more fields, then you can write more general homogeneous superpotentials as well. But basically, the requirement is that it's homogeneous and has R charge too. Which I think we are pretty much used from Landau-Ginzburg models in two dimensions. Okay, and then one can repeat the same thing for vector multiplets. And it's a little bit nastier to calculate. Now there are covariant derivatives, and those are only gauge covariant, and they contain the sigma left, the sigma I left. And yeah, that's not terribly enlightening to look at that. And the Lagrangians are like that, so the gauge Lagrangian, the gauge kinetic terms, they're basically this just the covariantized version of flat space, because where everything has already a determined R charge, the gauge field has always R charge zero, and I guess that's what helps there. Then you can have a theta term, and the Fi term is a little bit funny. It has this minus A zero in there. But if you integrate that, that's gauge invariant, that term. But it makes it quite hard, I think, to turn on the Phi-Eliopoulos term, because you modify the Gauss law constraints by that term. And so most likely, the Gauss law constraint comes by differentiating the Lagrangian with respect to A0, so you get basically always a constant. I suspect it tries to tell you that you better don't turn that thing on. But yeah. Something like that. So if you have a yeah. I mean, I got that just by making everything trying to make everything super symmetric, and I haven't played very much with that term. I just found it really funny to have that appear.
So if you don't have that term, the gospel tells you that everything must be symmetric. In the same way, it needs to be in some other representation. Maybe there's some background.
Yeah.
Right, suppose you have a long leading case. What
No, that the Phi-Eliopoulos term only works for the abelian. Yeah. In any case, for my talk, it won't be very important. It's just some curiosity that appeared there. And there are a few other terms which are new, which I kind of made some wiggly line below. That mass term is basically whatever is known as a curvature coupling. It appears for any charge and it always comes with a constant one in front. It actually doesn't depend on... Yeah, it does not depend on the R charge or anything like that.
But the hardest part is going to be to include that because of the thermal one dynamic.
Yeah, what I'm gonna assume is, I mean, those Lagrangians look very similar to flat space Lagrangians, so I basically, you know, I take theories which in flat space are believed to flow to some infrared fixed point, and I translate it to those Lagrangians. Basically, I take the same superpotential and same gauge group and matter content, and I just put those few extra terms around it, and Then I believe that it's going to flow to the same fixed point.
So you'll come to this dynamic argument, you'll find more in the thermal point.
Well, I don't really argue it. Okay. Okay. So what? Now that I derived all those fantastic Lagrangians, I want to play with them, and basically I want to look at chiral primaries, even though they are not counted by an index or so. But it's easier than actually counting the index because there are many more fields contributing to the index than to chiral primaries. And well, the chiral primaries saturate the BPS bounded E equals 3/2 R. So now I twist the theory and I use as my new Hamiltonian that H prime, and so all the chiral primaries are going to be ground states of that Hamiltonian. And basically I achieve this twisting already in the Lagrangian by just saying that phi gets an extra time dependence, which is determined by the R charge. Basically, phi rotates at a certain frequency on top of that, and that I can do by replacing time derivatives of phi by such a term. And then the thing that's happening is that my Lagrangian for the Vesomino model, actually, all the R charge dependence drops out of those kinetic terms, and I just get dt plus I and dt minus I is the time derivatives. And yeah, that's a Lagrangian that I'm gonna have to look at and find the ground states of that theory. So one in the first I'm going to start arguing what fields are going to remain in the free theory, and then I'm going to turn on the interaction part. And in the free theory, basically the spatial derivatives of phi and psi have to be zero, because those contribute basically to some potential energy. And basically the whole thing reduces to some quantum mechanics. And this is the quantum mechanical, like the first part is just the Lagrangian of some harmonic oscillator, which is viewed at in a frame which is rotating at the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. And that tells me that there is actually a zero mode. I can basically put the ball as far out as I want and it's going to stay there forever. And yeah, then one can actually derive, go to the canonical formalism and quantize that quantum mechanics. So the canonical conjugate momentum to phi is that P, which now contains this phi dagger, and I have to impose those anti-commutation relations, and due to my sign conventions of the in my space-time signature and the gamma matrices, I have to put a minus I here, because I always have to put a plus one in those fermionic anti-commutation relations. And then I have to adjust the bosonic commutation relations to that. And I get a Hamiltonian which looks like that. So if I forget the superpotential, this is just creation and annihilation operator for one mode, but I don't see there's a second pair of creation annihilation operators for the boson, which doesn't appear in the Hamiltonian. And then there's a psi dagger psi. And the supercharges one can also derive. They are given by that. And in the free theory, one can write actually the Hamiltonian just in that way, in terms of creation and annihilation operators, where they are defined like that, and A1 does not appear in the Hamiltonian. And for that reason, I can basically apply A1 as many times as I want, and I always have a ground state. And since A1 has a certain R charge, I can basically calculate the partition function of the chiral primaries, and it's given by that, where X is something like e to the minus beta times R charge of 1A. So that's not very surprising, it's just a harmonic oscillator. Now the next thing is what to do if we took a Vesomino model. Now, of course, that's not really believed to flow to some good infrared theory, but it's a nice example to calculate because it's fairly simple. So the classical PPS equations just tell me that W prime of phi has to be zero. Now you could argue maybe you can. The problem is that the superpotential is homogeneous, and in the untwisted theory I cannot deform it away from that, and I couldn't count how many vacua there are. But in the twisted theory you are actually allowed to, the R charge doesn't appear in the anti-commutation relations anymore on the right hand side. And one could deform it, and one would get n-1 solutions. So W is a polynomial of degree n. So I would get n-1 solutions, and so one expects n-1 chiral primaries for that. But since I deformed it, I broke R symmetry, and I cannot really see what R charges those guys have. So one needs to do better. And to do that, one needs to realize that phi, a chiral primary, is defined like that. And actually, I omitted the Q alpha on phi zero part. And I'm just looking at some kind of a cohomology. And then I count the, I define a chiral ring like that, and the elements in the chiral ring are in one-to-one correspondence with the chiral primaries. So I'm going to use those two supersymmetry generators, and the J invi- invariant states, that's in some Fock space notation. So the M1 and M2 are the oscillator numbers under A1 and A2. And the plus and the minus basically tells how the fermion is. And the most general SU2 left invariant state is some linear combination of those two, those infinitely many states. And then it's actually, well, maybe I should leave the transparency somewhat up there. Looking at those supercharges, one can see that this annihilates states of that form, because the first term has an A2, which is an annihilation operator for the second oscillator, but since there's a zero, it doesn't do anything. Well, it annihilates the state. And the second part has a B1 or a B2, which are the fermionic annihilation operators, and those also annihilate that state. So those states are Q alpha dagger closed. And then it's also not hard to see that states of that form, where I act with W prime on such a state again, those are Q dagger exact. So they're Q dagger of something. So from this we conclude that basically the chiral ring elements, which are non-trivial, are given by those states which are M1 and a 0 and the minus minus, and M1 can only go from 0 to N minus 2, and those are the N minus 1 chiral primaries. And now one can read off the R charges of that. And actually, I think I forgot to write down the partition function, but it's basically... Yeah, well, I wouldn't... The index, I don't know, the partition function for that. I mean, here I'm counting only chiral primaries. The index would count also those semi-long multiplets, and I would have to include... I don't know that in that case. I would suspect that it's a non-trivial function. I think in flat space we have similar problems, right? If we start with a Vesemino model and we define it at a certain scale, let's take a phi to the 4 theory, and we can calculate the index, which counts now the number of vacua on the 3 torus, and it's going to be the same number as here. Yeah, but if you now flow to the infrared, as long as you're away from the infrared, you always keep those vacua, but I think that limit is just not terribly regular at the end. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And I think that's the same here and in flat space. You always have to argue before that you have a non-trivial fixed point and nothing terribly happens when you flow there. Yeah, but somehow the coupling constant... Yeah, but if you go to the infrared, I think the coupling constant gets smaller and smaller, so it gets flatter and flatter, and then you probably have this, at some point, this transition that thing gets flat. Yeah. 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 I think that's what's happening.
Quite huge theories.
I thought not. Well, if you flow to a non-trivial point, I can tell you the number of fractura. But I'm not sure where you actually flow for the Western Union model.
It looks like in two dimensions, when Schoen class is not equal to zero, you only have a new set actually in a new model.
Yeah.
On a different field that is actually coupled. Vector that take care of the
Yeah, presumably you might flow to several different theories and they would take care of that. Okay. And well, the nice thing that helped with those ungauged theories is that you can actually do a consistent truncation of the field theory to some supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and I could just do some nice quantum mechanics here. And that doesn't seem to be true for gauge theories. I haven't been able to actually truncate that. And so one has to use more of chiral ring arguments and instead of truncating to quantum mechanics. So we basically again want to impose that we have singlets under the SU2 left and that we are annihilated by Q alpha dagger, and we again do some chiral ring by saying we care about states modulo Q alpha dagger exact states. And then one can expand fields in terms of spherical harmonics. So the scalar fields and fermions have those expansions. And the JEI invariant states have to have a zero in the first entry. And on top of that, they need to be Q alpha dagger invariant. So they need to be chiral. And there's a, looking at the supersymmetry variation tells that there's a phi and a lambda only left over. And the lambda has, of course, an index alpha. And now there are chiral ring relations, which is basically things which are zero modulo some Q alpha dagger exact term, and one gets basically that the lambdas commute and lambda commutes with phi and phi with phi. That's more or less some kinematical relations, and then there's in the classical theory or perturbative theory things like W prime of phi is zero, and also that Gaugino in a certain now put in with a representation matrix in a certain representation acting on a chiral field phi in that representation is actually zero. Those two relations one can get by looking at supersymmetry variations of some elementary fields. And there's a possibility of more relations by varying some more complicated things. And now I want to actually apply that for one example where you have Seebeck duality and you have two theories in the UV which are supposed to flow to the same theory in the infrared, and now I want to count the chiral primaries on the one side and on the other side and see whether it agrees. And that's in general quite complicated, but I managed it for SU2 with three flavors. Yeah. So I don't, since this is not an index here, and I'm not flowing to some, well, I'm flowing to some nice conformal fixed point, but I don't even have an index, so I have some, you know, BPS states that I'm counting, which are chiral primaries. I kind of have to hope that it's the same result. Well, there's some unpleasant history to the whole thing, because first I thought the index that I found counts chiral primaries, and I missed those semi-long multiplets, so I did everything for chiral primaries. Then I realized that that's not true. So.
Okay, like what if you take one of the theories that we're going to compare it, and counter one of them with a, say, one of the legal type theory that you argue for from reading the physical potential to the individual?
Yeah.
That doesn't change the principle.
Yeah, but if I had a theory which is supposed to flow nicely to some infrared fixed point, to some strongly interacting infrared fixed point, I
what?
Yeah. Sorry, some. I don't have a good argument for that, and here the situation is even worse. Even if I knew that, you know, vacua are not running off to infinity and stuff like that, it still could, you know, those chiral primaries could combine with some semi-long multiplets and just lift up and disappear forever in some finite time, and I just have to, you know, here I basically go lucky and it works. Yeah, sorry about that. But that's a little bit of a bummer. In any case, here it seems to basically almost work. So if I have SU2 with three flavors, it's actually six fundamental matter multiplets, because the fundamental and the anti-fundamental representation are the same for SU2. And you have a SU6 flavor symmetry. And then one can basically count the gauge invariant states that one can build out of those quarks. And I use those formulas, which I extracted from some paper by von Ramstong, Minwala, and friends from a few years ago. But it's basically character formulas. So the number of singlets is basically the number of singlets in some product of representations is calculated by this character formula, and I need to produce characters for symmetric products of representations, which is given by that formula. And then for this specific example, I now integrate over the SU2 group manifold. I have six flavors, or six quarks, and then one needs to insert the appropriate character here for the fundamental representation. And at the end of the day, one has to do some infinite sum and some integral, and that's all in Grudstein-Riesch. And one gets actually a fairly nice expression, which is this 1 plus 6x plus 6x squared plus x cubed over 1 minus x to the ninth. And now one can try to compare that to whatever one gets from the Seebeck dual. And actually, the Seebeck dual is a lambda, is a Wessomino model, because the Seebeck dual has a SU1 gauge group, and it has some dual meson matter, and those dual mesons are in anti-symmetric representations of the SU6 flavor group, and there's a superpotential given by that, and the superpotential basically says that those are two forms and the wedge product of two such two forms is zero. And now we need to count those, and one can represent the dual meson by some Young tableau for the anti-symmetric representation. And now I need to take the symmetric product of such mesons, and in the symmetric product the columns are always even, of even height. I cannot have odd heights. And furthermore, the superpotential constraint implies that if I have a column of height 4, that's 0, because that's the anti-symmetric product of two mesons. So the only representations that can contribute are actually such things which have only height 2 and are n, have the length n. And for that one can calculate the dimension. Which is given by that, and one can sum that up, and the result is the same. There's still one puzzle which I was not able to solve. On the gauge theory side, I only counted matter multiplets, and there's actually also a Gaugino bilinear. And the Gaugino bilinear satisfies some chiral ring relation which says that S squared is 0 for SU2, but it doesn't. But that would truncate only at the level S squared, so S would still contribute, and I don't know where that has gone. Well, so my guess is that there's some chiral ring relation which would truncate it here. It could also be your scenario that that guy also just wanders off to infinity and is never there. So that's a puzzle that I have, and I don't actually know the resolution. But still, it seems to work fairly well, this counting. That problem with the S is, I think, for any theory, for most theories which have Seebeck duality, because we basically have SUNC gauge theory with NF flavors, and that's supposed to be dual to some SUNF minus NC theory with NF flavors and some mesons. And here you get some chiral ring relation which would say that S to the NC, perturbatively it's 0, otherwise it's lambda to the 3N. For counting, it doesn't matter whether it's 0 or 3n, lambda to the 3n. And here you get S twiddle to the nf minus nc is 0. And for generic nf and nc, you're pretty much forced to say that S is S twiddle up to some constant, because that has R charge 1, and that has R charge 1. All the quarks and mesons and so on have pretty fractional R charges, and you hardly ever get a 1. So you're kind of forced to say something like that. And on the other hand, you truncate at different points, and you have to come up with something, some mechanism. There could be relations which say something like S to the NF minus NC is the determinant of the meson. I think that has the right charges. That could be a non-perturbative relation or something like that. I don't know. That is one possible solution. The other solution is, again, that they might go off to infinity. But in principle, you have the problem of matching those things. Okay, so much about the chiral primaries. About the index, I have less to say because I haven't really done the calculations yet. But there, one would have to basically now choose a twisted Hamiltonian, which is now twisted also by J3. And one can use the relation that Q1 with Q1 dagger is that twisted Hamiltonian. And then the 1/4 BPS states are in 1-to-1 correspondence with the Q1 dagger cohomology. And the index would have to be the Euler character of that cohomology. That is there. And actually, Maldacena and friends calculated that index for n equals 4 superangmills. So there, I think in their calculation, you can view you can forget about the extra supercharges, and you get some extra labels, which are due to the other R symmetry that you have around. But you can view those as some flavor symmetry of your n equals 1 theory. So I think you would get more or less the same by looking at this edit as n equals 1 theories. Now I'm pretty much at the end. So, well, I defined an index to count BPS states. I actually didn't manage to calculate it yet. I derived n equals 1 supersymmetric Lagrangians on S3 cross R. And those can, I can use Born-Oppenheimer approximation with those to describe BPS states, as I did with chiral primaries. One can do it also for more supersymmetric theories which have other BPS bounds. I also checked Seibach duality, and now there's a stupid green again. It would actually be interesting to, or good to calculate the index for theories which are not n equals 4 superangmills. So one could try to check Seibach duality again, or one can go use the Klebanov-Witten theory and calculate it for that. It would be good to understand whether there's some extra chiral ring relation, which I explained there over there, or what's the resolution of that puzzle, where do those states go. And it would also be good to look at n equals 1 large n gauge theories in the spirit of Bernstein, what he did for n equals 4 superangmills. And I think there was recently another paper about some beta deformations, and where he basically does something like a Born-Oppenheimer approximation to describe the dynamics of 1/16 BPS, no, 1/8 BPS states, and he recovers some geometry of the ADS from that. I haven't looked at it, but I guess you might be able to. I mean, I think as soon as you can extract something like a SU1/1 somewhere in the superconformal algebra, you could define an index using that thing.
Okay.